Thank you very much for the opportunity to come back to warm and sunny Brisbane. It's a great pleasure to be here again. You said I was a friend of the Economic Society. Indeed, I'm a member of it, the New South Wales branch, since 1970-something. So it's a long association and a valued one. Michael made reference to the previous occasion 2 years ago, and so I'd like to go back to that, and in fact I'd like to frame my remarks by talking about what we expected would happen in the intervening 2 years, what did and didn't happen, and what we learned from that, and then what implications that may have as we move on from here. So 2 years ago, in July 2013, when I was here, the economy was estimated to be growing at about 2.5%. Actually, with some data revisions, it now looks like it was a little less than that, but that's what the figures said at the time. Underlying inflation, 2.25 to 2.5, so consistent with our 2 to 3% target. Roll forward 2 years, the economy looks like it's growing at just shy of 2.5% in real terms. Inflation, about 2.25 to 2.5% in underlying terms, so consistent with the target. So in some respects, it seems nothing much has changed. In fact, a number of important things have occurred. Quite a bit of important water has gone under the bridge since then. Some of those developments were anticipated, some not. And overall, it's somewhat disappointing, in fact, that not much has changed, because we would have hoped the economy to have, in fact, picked up a little speed over that time. So I want to talk about what's happened and why. Turning first offshore then, 2 years ago, we thought Australia's trading partner group, that is weighted by our exports, was growing at about 4%. We expected that during 2014 and 15 that growth rate would pick up a bit to a little above average, 4% being the average pace. In fact, that hasn't happened. Growth for the trading partners has stayed at about 4% over that 2 years. It's still there and looks like it will be at about that pace for a while yet. Now, to be sure, 4% growth is faster than growth for the world economy as a whole. That's more like 3.25. So it's been to our advantage to have the high exposure that we do have to the faster growing Asian economies. An example of that, 2 years ago when we were here, the euro area had been in recession for 1.5 years. It was just about to start growing again. We were probably less affected by that than many countries, even though Europe is still a pretty substantial trading partner for Australia. At that time, I noted that the economy of the euro area was at that point smaller, this is 2013, smaller than it had been in 2008 before the financial crisis. That's actually still true. They haven't yet regained that peak. Europe is back on a growth path, which is good, but it's still a fairly modest one, and it seems to have taken extraordinary settings of monetary policy to make that happen. Growth in Japan has recently resumed after a dip in activity that followed the imposition of a higher consumption tax last year. Japanese growth rates overall remain pretty modest by our standards. Now, Japan has a falling population, so if you adjust for that and look at it in per capita terms, it doesn't look quite so weak. Nonetheless, it would be good if they could go faster, and the implementation, full implementation of the so-called third arrow of Abenomics could be expected, if that's done, to lift growth per head over time. Looking around the rest of Asia, growth is proceeding at a pretty reasonable clip. As I noted 2 years ago, in more than a few countries, it's proven not possible to regain the sorts of growth rates that were achieved prior to the financial crisis. That's still true. Moreover, the growth that has been achieved in a number of cases has been accompanied by an increase in debt owed by households or firms or both. How big a vulnerability that higher leverage will turn out to be under less benign financial conditions or slower growth, well, we can't know that. We will probably find out at some point in the next year or two. While it's been to our advantage, as I said, to have a lesser exposure to Europe than many other developed countries might have, the flip side of that is the greater exposure to China. And this has clearly worked for us so far, but it will mean that we're more sensitive to fluctuations in China's growth rates than other countries. That's not a new point. I started saying that 5 years ago, but it's more concrete now perhaps because China's growth rate has slowed appreciably in the past 2 or 3 years. The moderation that we saw in 2014 was, I think, more or less as the Chinese policymakers had intended. The further moderation seen this year, in the first half of the year, maybe was a little more than intended. Chinese policymakers have been responding to that, as you might expect. Interest rates are declining, selected restraints on credit are being eased, and so on. But stepping back from the ebb and flow of the short-run data in China, the big point is that China's policymakers are attempting two very significant transitions. The first of those is towards a more consumption-driven, domestically-driven growth path as opposed to an investment and export-led growth path. And they have to do that not only because that's actually in the interest of the Chinese people, which it is, but also because a continental-sized economy, which is what China's now becoming, just can't rely on the rest of the world absorbing rapid growth in their output, not at the pace that it used to. The second transition is towards a more robust financial structure, and that's necessary because the prevailing structure up to now has too many risky elements associated with it. So both these transitions are necessary, but both are works in progress. And so at the moment, unavoidably, for the world and particularly for us, they are a source of uncertainty. There's no escape from that. What does seem fairly clear is that the pace of growth in demand for commodities, like iron ore, for example, will be lower in future than in the past 5 years, even as supply of that product and other commodities continues to increase. So far, much of the additional supply has been Australian, but it's apparent that some of the future increase, at least, is going to be supply from other countries. It's not surprising, then, that in this environment, we've taken, as we do in our attempts to kind of distill things down into a single metric, we've taken to following the single metric of the daily fluctuations in the price of iron ore, which is traded daily and you can monitor that price every day. A few months ago, it even seemed to me as though the price of iron ore might just eclipse that other single price on which we focus obsessively, namely the price of a house. Silly me. House prices lately have regained their preeminent place in our national psyche, certainly in the city where I live. Turning away then from China towards the United States, it's quite significant, I think, that there's a good deal more optimism now in the US about the economic outlook. The rate of unemployment's fallen considerably, and growth in wages has begun to increase. Now, there was a weak March quarter output number, a GDP number, and most people think that's temporary, probably, though it does remain to be seen at this point just how robust the return to growth has been since then. But the significance of a healthy US economy, or a healthier US economy, is twofold. One is that expectations and sentiment of business people around the world, including in Australia, I think still take quite a strong cue from the tone of American business. So the fact that American business is more positive, that's valuable for sentiment elsewhere. And the second point, of course, as everyone knows, is that a healthier US economy means that US monetary policy will begin to adjust at some point accordingly. That will be a very gradual process, but at this stage, indications still seem to be that the Federal Reserve will begin that process sometime this year. It's reasonable to hope that that change, of course, can be accomplished without serious disruption to financial markets. I don't think it's likely that it'll be accomplished without any disruption at all. It never has been before. But it's reasonable to think that maybe we can get through without serious mishaps. But we can't be sure of that. Certainly countries that have been receiving cross-border capital flows have generally sought to strengthen their own fundamentals after the so-called taper tantrum of 2 years ago. They've been using that time to get in a stronger position for the inevitable lift in the funds rate. That's good. The fact that the Fed has signalled as clearly as you can how they think about this set of issues is also helpful. On the other hand, guidance, so-called, is no guarantee of smooth sailing, and we do start at a very unusual juncture. We have a combination of remarkably low interest rates globally, highly compressed risk premia, and diverging outlooks for monetary policy in the US as opposed to Europe or Japan. So that's a complex picture for both markets and policymakers to grapple with. Recently, we've seen some large, abrupt even, movements in currencies and commodity prices and even sovereign bond rates. And to some extent, that's a normalisation after a period of unbelievably low yields and very compressed, very, very low volatility. So something of a move back towards normal. But it is possible that these movements may be signalling a degree of underlying fragility that could have built up in the very long period of the search for yield. So those dynamics bear watching over the year ahead. Let me turn then to Australia. And recent growth, as Michael has clearly called it in no uncertain terms, has been on the disappointing side. Of course, we're not witnessing an economy in the progress of a normal economic expansion here. What we're witnessing is a lengthy and very complex adjustment to a once-in-a-century terms of trade event and an adjustment, an ongoing adjustment, to an earlier significant increase in household leverage. Both those things are important. During the late 1990s and early 2000s, very confident households spent and borrowed more and saved less, in the process extending their balance sheets. That process started to fade in about 2006, and then it finished more abruptly after the financial crisis broke. But by then, of course, the run-up in resource prices was imparting a very substantial stimulus to the economy. So that allowed pretty reasonable growth to continue for quite some time, even as other countries were still feeling the after effects of the financial crisis. But now, most of the capital spending that was needed to lift the output of the resource sector, particularly in iron ore, is done. There are still some very large LNG projects underway, but in time they will finish. And as that happens, the decline in resources investment, which started 2 years ago and is now well and truly underway, will continue, quite possibly accelerate. And the latest edition of the National Accounts released last week really paints this picture. The quarterly growth figure was stronger than we had anticipated when we published our statement on monetary policy in May. That, of course, comes after a weaker than expected outcome in the preceding quarter. Some of that strength resulted from unusually high export shipments of resources, which, as it turns out, were less affected than they often are at that time of year by the cyclone season. It looks like that experience has not been repeated in the June quarter, and in particular, shipments of coal were affected by weather disruptions on the East Coast. Taking the results over the past four quarters, growth in real growth was below trend. When you pull that apart, export volume growth contributed very strongly, while domestic final demand, that's our spending at home, increased by less than 1%. That's quite a weak result. Within that, housing construction rose strongly. We all know that's happening. Consumer spending over the year rose faster than income, that is, the saving rate declined. And both of those results owe a lot to low interest rates, the wealth of effects of rising asset values and so on. But other components of demand were weak. Business investment fell substantially as mining investment turned down and non-mining capital spending remained weak. public spending on goods and services didn't grow at all. And in fact, public investment spending fell 8% over the year to March. So if I think about how that compares with what we were saying 2 years ago, it's weaker. 2 years ago when I was here, our forecast was for growth in mid-2015 to be running in a range of 2.5% to 4%. That's a fairly wide range, though it's realistically wide given how unreliable forecasts are. So that's one reason for that width. Another reason was that we had pretty accommodative monetary policy. It's always a little bit difficult to tell when that's going to get traction, but if and when it did, it could get quite a bit of traction, so the pickup could be quite pronounced at some point. So we had quite a wide range for the forecast. Now, we're not going to know the final outcome for three more months until we get the June quarter accounts, which will be in September. But at this point, it's pretty likely that the outcome for the year to 2015 will be right at the bottom of that 2.5% to 4% range, or actually more likely a little bit below the bottom of that range. Now, forecasts, of course, are hardly more than educated guesswork, frankly. 2 year ahead forecasts, even more so. That there are inevitably errors is neither surprising nor new, and it's not especially concerning any more than it ever has been anyway. And this is far from the biggest error I've seen, believe me, in my 35 years in this business. But it is interesting to think about what's turned out differently and what's adjusted accordingly to that difference. So let me tell you. And the following points are prominent. The first one is the terms of trade, which 2 years ago were assumed to fall, but they've fallen further by about 12%, in fact, which is significant compared to that forecast. That means national incomes lower, as Michael was saying, purchasing power, therefore, also lower. The exchange rate, which in mid-2013 in our forecast was assumed to be 104, well, it's not there now. It's 25% lower than that. That is, it's moved in the same direction as the terms of trade have, and that directional change, at least, is normal. That lower exchange rate has helped to produce a contribution to growth from net exports, so-called, much bigger than we forecast 2 years ago, while the contribution from domestic spending has been considerably smaller. And that latter weaker domestic spending was, as I said, spread across non-mining business investment, weaker government spending, and softer consumption because income is softer. The one thing which isn't that different to what we anticipated 2 years ago is the big fall in mining spending. That actually, that's been pretty well anticipated. Now, because the net effect of all of that is that GDP growth's a little lower than expected, the unemployment rate is therefore a bit higher than expected, about half a percentage point higher than our 2 year ago forecast. Consistent with that, when you think about that's a weaker labour market, so what's happened to wages? Well, wage growth is slower than we anticipated 2 years ago. That would have meant inflation being lower, but the fall in the exchange rate has acted in the reverse direction. And so while headline inflation is lower than forecast, mainly because of the recent decline in oil prices, underlying inflation is still in the 2 to 3% range, not very different from the 2 year ago forecast. And then finally, the cash rate is 75 basis points lower than the forecast 2 years ago assumed. That's because monetary policy has used the room afforded by contained inflation to try to do more to help growth. Lending rates, on average, have in fact fallen further than the cash rate. They've fallen by about 100 points over that period. You didn't read outrage in the media, I notice, about the banks not matching the cash rate exactly when things were going in that direction, but that is the result we've had. So that's produced a stronger result for housing construction than we anticipated, and it's presumably also contributed to the rise in dwelling prices and so on. So to sum all that up, in several important respects, the economy's followed a somewhat different trajectory from the one that we anticipated 2 years ago, partly because things in the world turned out differently to what we'd assumed, and partly because some domestic things have been different. And we've seen some inbuilt responses to that change. The exchange rate has declined, perhaps not as much as we might have thought it should and still think it should, but at least it's moved in the correct direction. That's had the effect of helping growth and stopping inflation falling as much as it might have. And of course, monetary policy, as I said, has responded to the evolving situation consistent with the Reserve Bank's mandate. So what those responses have done is lessened the extent to which the outcomes have fallen short of forecasts, but they haven't managed to make those differences go away entirely, certainly not in the case of growth. I might add that the slowing in wages growth in response to soft labour market conditions is another inbuilt response in the economy. In fact, on our reckoning, wage growth looks lower at present than you would have expected given previous relationships with the rate of unemployment. That might be a sign of increased flexibility in the labour market. It might help to explain a bit of a puzzle as to why employment in the last 6 or 9 months has looked stronger relative to GDP than you might have thought. They're hypotheses. They could only be advanced very tentatively because we're going to need more data yet before we can draw any conclusions there, but they're interesting hypotheses. Looking ahead, the most recent forecasts suggest that growth rates in the near term will be similar to the ones we've been observing recently. That is a bit below trend. Residential investment will reach a new high this year. Household consumption will grow at a moderate pace. With national income quite weak as a result of the falling terms of trade, that requires a further modest decline in the saving rate. It doesn't really seem reasonable to me to expect much more from the consumer than that, actually. Resources sector investment has a good deal further to fall yet over the next 2 years. Non-resource sector business investment, which has been very low, and something which I would have expected by now would have been showing clearer signs of strengthening, but the most recent data suggest, if anything, that it will fall rather than rise. And then public spending, of course, hasn't been growing, and fiscal consolidation has a way to go yet. In the current circumstances, it wouldn't seem appropriate to me for governments to seek additional restraint on top of what they've already sought in the near term. In the meantime, inflation is likely to remain low. Growth in labour costs, as I say, is very low, and some of the forces of an administrative nature which were pushing up inflation rates a year or two back are actually now going in the other direction. So even if the exchange rate were to fall further, which in my opinion it needs to, we seem unlikely to have a problem with excessive inflation anytime soon. So putting all that together, as things stand, the economy's growing, but it could do with a bit more demand than we presently forecast over the next couple of years. Now, of course, these are forecasts. They could be wrong. They will be wrong, actually, in some dimension or other. That's the nature of forecasts. And so our published material goes to some lengths to articulate a range of risks, so-called. Risk is the fancy word for things that might happen to make the forecast not turn out. It's easy to think of downside risks, so-called, at the moment, in our mood of determined pessimism. It's not entirely impossible, though, to think of some upside ones. Here's one, a further fall in the exchange rate, if that occurred, and that's not assumed in the forecast. That would impart an upside risk to both growth and prices. So if you think that decline is likely at some point, well, that would constitute an upside risk. Now, of course, the list of countries in the world that would prefer a lower exchange rate to the one they have, that's a very long list. And we can't all have it, of course, by definition. That being so, we might give some thought to trying to create some upside elsewhere to the growth outlook in particular by some set of policy initiatives or other. You'd expect me to say this, but the Reserve Bank will, of course, remain attuned to what it can do, consistent with our mandate, That mandate includes price stability, full employment, and I think clearly these days financial stability. We remain open to the possibility of further easing if, on balance, that would be beneficial for sustainable growth. And let me emphasise sustainable when I say that. The temptation, of course, is to presume that policy outcomes can be fine-tuned, or economic outcomes can be fine-tuned by policy, that we can simply dial up a little bit more or a little bit less demand to keep things on exactly the right path. Reality, I'm here to tell you, if you didn't know, is inevitably more messy than that, and history hasn't been kind, actually, to such fine-tuning notions. As it is, some observers pardon me, think monetary policy's done too little. Others think it's already done way too much. I, of course, think it's done about the right amount. I would say that, but I think that's the case. But the bigger point, the much bigger point, regardless of where you stand in that discussion, here's the big point. Monetary policy alone can't deliver and won't deliver everything we need, and expecting too much from it can lead in time to much bigger problems. Much of the effect of monetary policy easing comes through the spending, borrowing, and saving decisions of households. There's actually very little evidence in research and no encouragement from current data to think that there's a direct impact in business investment. You just can't find that. You can find it in the various dimensions of housing and consumption and a little bit on the exchange rate. That's empirically where it comes from. But of the three broad sectors of the economy, if you think of the three broad sectors being households, business, or corporations, and governments, the one of those three which is least in a position to expand its balance sheet and gear up to drive spending is households. And the reason for that is they've already done it. They did it a decade or more ago, and that process is finished. Their debt burden, certainly being very well serviced, very low arrears and so on, all manageable. But the question is, can it sustainably rise materially from here? And it's for that reason that I've previously noted some reservations about how much monetary policy per se can be expected to do to boost growth with lower and lower interest rates. It isn't that monetary policy is entirely powerless. We're not saying that. But its marginal efficiency may be smaller and the associated risks greater the lower interest rates go from already very low levels. And everyone can see that, I think. So if that's true, it's doubly important then that other policies coalesce around a narrative for growth. So here, just in passing, I note that I think the federal government's on the right track in not seeking to compensate in the near term for lower revenue by cutting spending further. I think that'd be unhelpful in the near-term conjuncture. That doesn't alleviate the medium-term issue, that the revenue and spending lines don't meet adequately. We all know that. We know that we have to have a conversation about that over time if we're to sustain confidence, and we know that that will be a difficult conversation. But meanwhile, it's often remarked that infrastructure spending has a role to play in sustaining growth and also in generating confidence. Well, I agree with that. I'm rather doubtful of our capacity to deploy infrastructure spending as a short-term counter-cyclical device. I think the evidence of history is it takes too long to start it and then too long to stop it. But it would be confidence-enhancing, I think, if there was an agreed story about a long-run pipeline of infrastructure spending, if that was surrounded by appropriate governance in project selection, appropriate risk sharing between the public and private sectors, and both have a role to play, and appropriate pricing of the use of the infrastructure once it's finished. In that world, the suppliers, the construction companies and so on, would feel it worth their while to improve their offering if the projects were not just one-time projects. The financial sector would be attracted to the financing and also the ownership of infrastructure assets. the real economy would, of course, benefit from a pipeline of construction works, a steady pipeline as opposed to a boom and bust. More importantly, in the long run, we would benefit from improved efficiency of logistics that would come from the better infrastructure. Amenity would be improved for millions of Australians in their daily lives. We could unleash large potential benefits that at present are not being realised because of congestion in our transportation networks. The impediments to that outcome are not financial. The funding would be available. Long-term interest rates are as low as we've ever seen or ever will. The funding isn't the problem. It's perfectly sensible, by the way, for some public debt to be used judiciously to fund infrastructure that will earn a return. You price it, it earns a return. It services the debt. That isn't the same as borrowing to pay pensions or public servant wages. So the impediments to the world I describe, possibly naively, they're not in the financing. They seem to be in our decision-making processes, and it would seem in our inability to find political agreement on how to proceed. Of course, physical infrastructure is only part of what we need. The confidence-enhancing narrative that's pro-growth needs to extend to other areas, and these are not my field of expertise, and I'm not going to be able to answer detailed questions on them, but things like skills, education, technology, the ability and freedom to respond to incentives, the ability to adapt, the willingness to take on risk. All those areas, and these things often get much less attention than they really should. It's in those areas, and there are some initiatives underway in some of those areas, but it's in those areas we need to create as well a positive dynamic of confidence, of innovation and investment, and ultimately well-being. That, ladies and gentlemen, that's the upside that we need to create. And with that, I thank you for your attention, and I will now have questions. Thank you.
Governor, I was really interested to what you said about falling wages and falling inflation. You said that in a normal circumstance, those falling wages would have generated falling inflation, and I got the impression from you that that could have put some downward pressure on interest rates if that occurred. But you said, in fact, that didn't happen because inflation was higher because the exchange rate went down, therefore import prices were a touch higher. So can I read from that that inflation stabilises, the exchange rate stabilises later in the year, that might give the bank room for more action, perhaps.
So we've gone straight to the interest rate question, Michael.
No, I've gone straight to the interest
rate question. With a very elaborate ploy to get there. But let me respond to some of the premise that you put. What I'm saying is there seems to be some evidence that growth in labour costs is a bit lower than you would expect given the rate of unemployment. That could be because there are measures of underemployment that are more of the story, possibly that. But certainly labour costs are very restrained. Where does the benefit, quote-unquote, of that go? Part of it could go to profit margins, and it may have just a little bit. Part of it comes through into lower core inflation. And then the exchange rate declining, which is the relative price shift that we have thought we needed, pushes up the prices for traded goods and services. The inflation outlook, monetary policy has responded to that, actually, because we've said on a number of occasions that we had scope, one of my favourite words, to ease if that was helpful to support demand, because the inflation outlook looks pretty secure, and we've done that to the tune of 75 basis points since I was last here, or 100 points actually on lending rates. So it's not as though policy hasn't taken opportunity. From here, I would only repeat what I've said. We will look at the incoming data. This is what the statement said on board day, and assess what that tells us about the outlook and what the appropriate stance is, and whether this stance or another one would be better for fostering sustainable growth. But again, emphasise sustainable. Some short-term burst that then fades and gives us a bigger problem later might not be the trade-off to make. So that's probably as much as I want to say about that one today.
Last time you were here, we talked about the risk appetite, and we talked about the way that you had to move interest rates further to get the same effect in the world after the global financial crisis as you did before the global financial crisis. It seemed that business was a bit more scared after the financial crisis, and that therefore their sense of risk was greater, but anyway, their appetite for investing was greater, needed lower interest rates to have the same effect. Do you have a broad guesstimate of what that interest rate effect is? You know, do you need interest rates now maybe 1% lower or a bit more than 1% lower or 2% lower than you did before? Or is just you're working through it step by step to discover where the right interest rate is?
Well, there's no precision on these things. We have said many times that it seems that what used to be thought of as the neutral, quote-unquote, rate, you can think of reasons why that would be lower in the present circumstances than it used to be, and that would probably stay the case for a while. And most countries, I think, believe that and have found that. But this is not it's a conceptual device, the natural interest rate. It's not an empirical magnitude you can go look up in an ABS release any more than the natural rate of unemployment and so on. So there's always, I think, an element of learning in policy formulation. The world is never quite the same as it used to be. There are always new things happening, and you have to keep in the back of your mind that we've got to extract new information out of the data that we received as to how effective policy can be. That having been said, it does seem to me that in many cases the rates of return on an investment that businesses think should be earned haven't really fallen in a world of extremely low funding costs. Now, some people claim that in some cases it has come down, so that's good. But my suspicion is that in many places in the world and in many lines of business, including here, the rates of return that shareholders, analysts, management think they have to earn haven't really responded much to the fact that the riskless rate is incredibly low and won't be this low indefinitely, but likely that low risk rates are pretty low for quite a while. But this is in a sense why there isn't much evidence that monetary policy directly affects business investment, because we can't simultaneously determine the riskless rate and the risk premium that the investors want to apply. The risk premium they want to apply is in their hands.
I went to a presentation earlier in the year by Larry Summers, who was previously a US Treasury Secretary, and he was a candidate for a time to be chair of the Fed. And he was saying in his presentation that when the Fed starts to tighten, it'll really only go part of the way towards what previously would have been regarded as normalisation. He was saying that he thought that interest rates, the Fed funds rate, get up to 2.5%, and then sometime in the next cycle it'll fall down to zero again, and maybe we'd have QE again. A year ago you talked about the idea of normalisation, and that Australian interest rates would eventually, after this cycle, go back up towards a level that might be something like the not long-term average levels. How far away do you now look? Last year you thought, you hoped that that would happen in a couple of years, but how long do you think it will take now, or how many cycles will it take, do you think?
Well, no, I'm not sure that we will see normal quote-unquote even here any time soon. I mean, I think it's quite some time before we even think about interest rates going up. And where normal is going to be a judgment call, and the world is a different world. So you've got to try to factor all that in. And in a sense, that's what Larry Summers is saying the Fed has to do. Just on the Fed, though, 2.5's a fair distance from where they are now, and that's quite a lot of adjustment to manage carefully along the way. So I think the key thing is to get off to a measured, reasonable start. That will itself, if that can happen this year for them, start to reduce uncertainty, and that will be good.
Now, do we have questions from the audience? Okay. So if we could go to Jean Tunney. Do we have a mic? Okay, sorry, Ken Howard.
Yeah. Michael, Glenn Stevens, I'm interested in your concluding comments about opportunities for structural change and the mix of the Australian economy and what's going to drive us in the future. Clearly, we've enjoyed the boom of the primary industry, but what's going to be the boom for the next decade to lift Australia forward?
Well, I can't tell you. If we'd sat here 20 years ago, 25 years ago in the depths of the early 90s recession, and asked the question, where will the growth come from? You know, we'd have concocted some answers as a bunch of economists. If there's 400 of us here, we'd have come up with 1,000 answers probably between us. I bet none of those answers would have accurately predicted the way the structure of the economy has altered in the intervening 25 years or so. And so you can't predict actually exactly in what areas the growth will come. I think the thing though, pardon me, is not to try to predict that, is to try to think about what capabilities, pardon me, we need to be working on so that we can adapt to whatever changes come along. That's the thing we need most to be doing, I think, is asking ourselves, are we equipped to cope with a rapidly changing world, technology, internationalisation, all of that stuff, and be ready to seize opportunities when they present, which they will. If we don't grab them, someone else does. So are we adequately equipped in all our structures to do that? That way, wherever the growth comes from, we'll be positioned to take advantage of it. You would not have predicted, actually, in 1990 that in 2015 we would be talking about how to manage the downward phase of the largest terms of trade boom for 150 years. Nobody picked that, that I know of anyway, 20 or 25 years ago. So that's an example of the fact that you just can't tell, but what you can do is try to ensure an economy that where people are well trained, have the right technology, the right adaptability, flexibility, capability to respond to what comes along. So it's again back to Gary Banks's to-do list speech, for which I feel I should get some royalties, because it was actually at a presentation in Brisbane that I coined the term the list, and he very kindly went and wrote it down. Flexibilities, capabilities, and incentives. That's what they were the three sets of things that he talked about, and then fleshed them out. You know, get the list. That they're the things to do. What it won't come from is cheap money.
I think there's a question in the middle there. Jean Tunney?
Governor, just wondering on that question of the return to more normal interest rates, which is obviously, you know, an important question, when that will occur, and you say it won't happen anytime soon, but given your views on, you know, forecasts and accuracy of it, would you agree that this is not something you really can forecast, and that when it does happen, it will happen abruptly, and there'll be a major discontinuity there?
Well, if you can't forecast it, then I'm not sure you can forecast it will be abrupt either. It could be abrupt or slow. I certainly agree with the premise that you can't forecast very well. What will we be doing in a year? I don't know. I think all one can do is observe that you can think of reasons why whatever normal is today, it's for a while lower than it used to be. And you can talk about how gingerly central banks might need to reapproach that. And I think generally central banks will be quite careful in doing that. And then you have to say, but we really don't know what else is going to come along. Absolutely.
Is there a question over there?
Yes. So just looking around the world's financial markets at the moment, there has been a lot of money sort of pumped around the globe. We've seen a lot of investment go into the Chinese domestic market from the Chinese banks, sometimes at the direction of the Chinese government, and that's led to, you know, a fair bit of property investment, and more recently quite a run in their share price, which, you know, has been fueled to a degree by margin loans. If there was to be an issue in the Chinese banking market, is the Chinese government adequately equipped to basically cover that before it spreads any further than China?
That's a good question. All of what you say is true. And we've held the view for some time that managing all of that back down to earth without crashing is no small feat. My guess is if anyone can do it, they can, but that's not a guarantee they can. The two comments I'd offer, I guess, is my sense is that the Chinese authorities in the central bank, the supervisory areas and so on, are very well across the problems. And secondly, I would expect that if it requires financial resources of the government at some point, they have those resources. So those are both supportive points for an outcome that's not too bad. But it is a difficult thing to do, to try to do what they're doing. And they are pretty determined to move off this model of force-feeding credit into the system as a macroeconomic tool. And I think it's right that they are determined to get off that. But they've got to manage this legacy of previous policies that have left something of a hangover. And that will involve a whole host of things, better regulation of, you know, the so-called shadow banking, more liberalisation of the regulated parts of the economy, done very carefully because we know ourselves. It's all very well to say, let's take the shackles off, but silly things happen when you do that. So, done with care. Provincial governments need a better source of revenue than property development sales. That's an inherent weakness and danger in the system. So those things and more all have to be addressed. They're across that, but no small task, which is why I say in the talk it's a work in progress.
Are there further questions? Yep. If you could just identify yourself before you ask the question. I think... excellent.
Tim Lawless from CoreLogic Appy Data. You mentioned, Governor, thank you for your presentation, by the way. You mentioned leverage across the households is it now at record levels, about 153% or so. Most of that is housing debt. We've seen Sydney dwelling values rise by about 15% the last year and about 65% post-2008. do you think if housing values continue to rise at that pace, that will stay the RBA's hand for lower interest rates?
This is another oblique, not that oblique actually, approach to the interest rate question. Do you want me to comment on the housing market? It's what's happening in housing in Sydney is clearly, I find it acutely concerning for a host of reasons, many of which are not to do with monetary policy. I think it's a social problem. I would simply make the point that, firstly, asset booms, there are asset booms and asset booms. The ones that do the damage are the ones with a lot of leverage, which is why in housing you have to pay attention and you have to focus on lending standards and credit growth, which is exactly what we're doing, trying to ensure that lending standards are maintained and indeed improved. I think Wayne's speech the other day showed areas of concern there and a need not just for maintenance of lending standards but an improvement. And we have to take account of the housing price dynamics. Of course, that's Sydney. Sydney's not the whole country. Prices in Brisbane are, I think, rising, but at nothing like that pace. There's not much happening in Adelaide. Perth, they're probably falling. Canberra, not much happening. Regional centres around the country, not much happening. So when you when you're devising macroeconomic policy for the country, yes, I'm very concerned about Sydney. I think some of what's happening is crazy, but we've got a national focus to manage as well, and that just increases the complexity. On whether or not that stays any hands, I have no comment to make today.
So we have time for just one more question, which I think is from the front here.
Matt Wright, Commonwealth Bank. With regards to your point on the economy split between households, corporates and governments, and that households cannot materially take on any more debt, then I guess my question is, why would the federal government be hesitant to take on more debt? It seems that corporates, from my point of view, are sitting on the sideline a little. And compounding on that, state governments are also doing the same with their debt burdens, not just Queensland, but several of the other governments have a significant amount of state-based debt. So I guess that all being said, the rating agencies have come out and said that the feds can borrow more for infrastructure. So why wouldn't they? And on top of that, wouldn't that grow the economy significantly more than what's happening now?
I haven't come to Brisbane to give a gratuitous lecture to the federal government about whether or not to borrow. The points, as in the speech, it matters what you borrow for. So when we're thinking about whether debt's good or bad, we've got to ask what's the debt for, because I think that matters. And I think the other observation is that the Treasurer, I think rightly, has made a major point of trying to talk up and actually grow the infrastructure pipeline. I think, personally, and all that's good, we need that pipeline, if anything, in the longer term to be bigger, but we also need it to be more bipartisanly supported on a more bipartisan basis, as I don't need to tell you in Queensland. When one party commits and another party reverses, regardless of who is right or wrong, that makes it difficult for the industry, difficult for certainty. So can't we get a better agreed set of what we're going to plan for what we're going to do, make it a long-run one, and have governments, state and federal, stick to that? The financing part is the easy part. The hard part in infrastructure is which projects, through which electorate, upsetting which group of people, but in the greater good, and how do we govern that? How do we choose? How do we govern the process? How do we share the risk, and how do we price? They're actually the hard questions. Funding is the easy part.